It's great to see you back again. Thank you for coming. I'm trying to get used to these lights, actually. I'd love to look into your lovely, cheery faces. So forgive me if I look like I'm in the Caribbean. It would be nice to be in the Caribbean, actually, but there you go. I should have my shorts on, indeed. Thank you for that. Just to say one thing from yesterday, then I'll pray, and then we'll get into today's session. But there was a really good question asked at the end of yesterday when we were talking about preaching, and I'd mentioned about I always use a full manuscript. And somebody very rightly raised the point, you know, she gets fed up with seeing people using full manuscripts because they're always reading. How do you stop that? And of course, that's very important. You don't want, when you're coming up to preach, for people to look like you're reading a manuscript all the time and barely ever looking up. One, actually, consolidation for that is Jonathan Edwards, the great Puritan preacher. He had to make little comments in his manuscript because we still have his sermon manuscripts. In fact, there's a whole area of Yale theology department in the States that looks at Jonathan Edwards' preaching manuscripts. Fascinating. And he used to put little asides, look up to the people now. You know, he was such an academic and he was so engaged in his, you know, technical studies that the struggle for him was a people-centeredness, a people consciousness while he was preaching. God still managed to bring revival through him, so, you know, God can use us all. But essentially, eye contact is so important in preaching, and people often say that. He says as he's trying to cover his eyes. Particularly, actually, for there are particular emotive moments in a sermon or moments where you're wanting to emphasize a key phrase. We've just seen it with John Stevens, actually. There were a couple of key phrases that he repeated that were core phrases. We're not saved by good works, but for good works. He repeated that three times, because that's such a key phrase. You don't want to be saying that like this. We're not saved by good works, we're saved for good works. You can do this quite a lot if you're quoting from the Bible or quoting, you know, people will let you get, that's a natural time to be looking down at paper. But especially when you're giving an illustration or when you're emphasizing a main point, we're not saved by good works, but for good works, you want to be really engaging with the people. And it will feel odd then if somebody's been looking at you for, here's what the text says, but is not looking at you for, here's the practical application. You really want somebody to be engaging with your spirit at the most emotive moment. So if you're looking at a page, that stops the Word of God process. God has planned preaching to be one vulnerable person communicating to the spirits of a whole bunch of people, and you can't do that without eye contact. Anyway, how do you go up with a full manuscript but not look like you're reading it? The only two things I would say is, number one, if you've got a very clear outline and you've been mulling over your sermon all week, you've been, you know, vegetating on it almost. You know, you've done your 15 hours and you've been rewriting it and rehearsing it and all this kind of stuff. You'll be amazed at how much is in there anyway, so that somebody could take your manuscript away and you wouldn't reproduce every word, but you could reproduce a fair chunk of it. I've had that a couple of times, actually. I literally lost my notes and think, oh my goodness. And when you're a full manuscript guy, that's a panic scenario. And reproducing that. But actually, it's surprising how much comes back to you because you have been living this sermon. You can't preach a sermon that's actually somebody else's sermon and you're just borrowing it for the day. It must be something that's set your own soul on fire. And when that's happened, then you can regurgitate a lot of it. But not just having a clear outline, I literally have to go through that slightly artificial moment of I'll go over it three times before I get up to preach it. And I'll try and do that in the most realistic way possible. I go into my study. I have a music stand, which I've stolen from the church. I hope the musicians don't mind that. And I get it up to the height that my pulpit, I literally make it as realistic as I can. And I'm preaching to the walls, you know. But I will be going through the mechanism, getting myself going that way so that I am as fully prepared for the event as I can be. Strangely, what I was saying to somebody earlier is I've stopped doing it three times and I've started doing it two times now. Because when I was doing it three times, I started to get a little bit bored with the process before I got up to preach. And you don't want to be bored with your sermon before you get up to preach. And there's no hope for the congregation then. If you're bored with it, if you don't want to hear your own voice, you know. But if that's a help, go over it a couple of times close to the event. Make sure your outline's clear. And honestly, some people think I don't have notes. We've destroyed that now because I've got this Perspex pulpit, which is a big see-through thing, you know, so you can see the notes there, which is a right bummer. I should have thought about that beforehand. But I've learned to trust a guy who goes up with notes. A guy who goes up with notes says to me, they've really prepared and struggled over this. And actually, they've got 11. I always go up with about 11 pages. And I'm going through those 11 pages. But I think over a period of time, when your congregation know you and you know your congregation, they actually really appreciate the fact that you have bunches of paper there because you really wrestled over this for them for the 30, 40 minutes you're going to produce in front of them. Okay? Anyway, I don't want to drift into yesterday's seminar. But hopefully that's a helpful answer to that question. Let me just pray now as we move into the really important topic of building a disciple-making church is the big, big idea of these three seminars, if you like. And yesterday, point one was biblical preaching, without which no discipleship can happen. And point two today is training younger leaders. What does that look like? How can I start to do that? So let me pray that God will make this useful for us all. Father, just thank you for everybody gathered here, the very different churches and scenarios that we represent. I pray, Lord, that my scenario in Aberdeen will be very different to a lot of guys' scenarios here. I pray, Lord, that you'll help us to, in that sense, interpret through your Spirit what I'm sharing from my experience, so that it'll be helpful to everybody here. Save me from saying stupid things, and help me to say helpful and insightful things by your Spirit that will bless all of us, not just for this session, but bleeding into the life of our churches and perhaps the young guys and girls in front of us whom we haven't thought of before as leadership training material, whom we need to start thinking about in that way. So help us, Lord, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Right, again, as yesterday, what I want to start with, kind of bullet point one here, is the convictions, the biblical convictions behind training younger leaders. It's not just a nice idea. Wouldn't it be nice to add that element to your church life? It's actually right through Jesus' ministry. And I had been in gospel work for quite a few years without actually realizing that. There was a book that I was given, a very old book, by a guy called Robert Coleman, called The Master Plan of Evangelism, which actually isn't really about evangelism. It's about training younger leaders. And this book had been revolutionary in the United States. It's a 100-page paperback. It's deadly simple, soaked in Scripture, just setting out Jesus' strategy of training younger leaders and how much time he devoted to that. So that's where I want to begin, really. Jesus' attitude to training the 12. And when you think about it, the Son of God had 3 years of public ministry. It's one of the most stunning things about his life, you know, that so much of his life actually was lived in obscurity. I mean, what's happening between when he's, you know, fugitive in Egypt, comes back, then we know nothing until he's 12 years old. Luke gives us one story about his kind of bar mitzvah at 12 years old. Then there's nothing until he's 30. What's going on there? It's just very interesting. He lives most of his life in obscurity, which I actually find very helpful if I feel that in my gospel ministry it's very obscure. You know, I've got 10 people in my church who sit in the living room staring at each other sometimes, and the prayer time last week was just so bleak. What am I doing here, Lord? Jesus lived a lot of his life in utter obscurity. Nobody knew a thing about him. Is this not the son of Joseph the carpenter? Can anything good come from Nazareth? Yes. God in flesh came from Nazareth. Population 120 in Jesus' day. Archaeologists have rediscovered the ancient Nazareth. They couldn't find it for a long time because it was so tiny. 120 people was the local population of Nazareth where Jesus grew up. Anyway, Jesus then had 3 years in the public limelight, as it were. And during those 3 years, we notice more and more, to begin with, yes, he's preaching to the crowds. He's doing his feeding of the 5,000. He's doing his Beatitudes, his Sermon on the Mount, and all that kind of stuff. But the more time passes that 3 years, the more focus that he gives to his 12. Because he is going to begin his rescue operation through the world, not just by the things that he's going to say, but through the leaders he's going to train. And that becomes more and more of a priority to him. And of course, what we were thinking about last night, John 13 to 17, one night of Jesus' life takes up five full chapters of John's gospel. It was so important. This was the last thing that Jesus did the night before he was to die. What was his absolute priority? It wasn't, well, let me find 10,000 people somewhere that I can be an evangelist to. No. Let me go to my 12. Let me wash their feet. Let me show them the kind of leaders they need to be. Let me teach them about vine and the branches. Let me teach them about the Holy Spirit who'll come to be their helper. And that's the most important thing for me to do on the last night of my life before they watch me be kissed by my betrayer, be crucified, and rise again from the dead. He wanted to be with his 12. And I think we need to change our understanding about the value of speaking to crowds and the value of investing in a small number of key individuals who will be your leaders. I think we put much more effort into speaking to the crowds whom we maybe see once a week or twice a week. And we need to put a lot more time into investing in key individuals whom we really invest in, whom we have in our homes, who we have in our lives, who we meet up with at their work, whom we train, whom we spend time with, that we spend time with nobody else. Because those are the people that we need to invest in. That's exactly Jesus' strategy. And let me say here particularly, Jesus had various groups that became his people that were going to do his mission for him. Remember, he said to the disciples, "You will do greater things than I do." What did he mean by that? He had raised the dead. He had walked on water. How are we going to do greater? He never, in that sense, brought biblical conversion to people because he hadn't produced the gospel yet, because he hadn't died and risen from the dead. And the greater things that he calls you and I to do is not actually to raise the dead or put on massive healing services, but to be gospel ministers, to bring biblical conversion to lost people. That's the greater things that we are doing. And Jesus says, guys, go and do it. But he was absolutely intent on training his 12, giving them an inordinate amount of time. And how many times he'll have been preaching to the crowds in parables, and then the crowds disappear, but he then gets his disciples together. Yes, guys, you've heard that teaching, but let me give you some insider truth as well here. Guys, I'm constantly teaching you. I'm constantly training you. I'm constantly preparing you for you, because you're going to change the world. I'm going to change the world by dying and rising again. You're going to change the world by taking that message out in the next generation. Jesus had his 72. You remember that one passage in Luke we have? He has the 72 that he sends out into all the villages and towns and so on. They're not named at all. Then he has his 12, which he spends more time with than the 72. It seems to me there's more emphasis on the 12. They're all named. But after they're named as his disciples, we don't hear about a lot of them very much. I mean, we don't hear about, you know, Bartholomew very much or some of the other. They're just named as his disciples. And then he has his 3, which we hear about all the time. Peter, James, and John. So even in his 12, he was thinking now, there's 3 out of this 12 who are really going to be the ones I'm going to most fully invest in. You kind of think, how did he make that decision? What did he see in them that was different to the 12? And what did the other 9 think when Jesus took the 3 aside? Jesus wasn't afraid to take aside 1 or 3 or 12 and especially invest in them. He wasn't afraid about the jealousy that might create. And of course, there was huge jealousy in the disciples, wasn't there, generally? Like the sons of thunder's mother saying, "We want James and John to be on your right and your left." You can imagine some of the conversations that were happening among the disciples, you know. So you have Matthew, the tax collector, who is in league with the Romans before he gets converted, sitting next to Simon the Zealot, who has a dagger up his cloak to kill anybody who's invested with him. There's Jesus' small group, guys. You know, if you're struggling with your small groups, you imagine what Jesus went through sometimes, and the cattiness between them, the stupidity of them. You know, so after Jesus says, "You must become like little children," they go off and argue with each other about who's the greatest. You know, here's the beautiful thing as well. When you invest in young leaders, you will have many holding hands in your head moments, or head in your hands moments. That's probably a better way of saying it. Because they will be just like the disciples. The disciples were utterly pig-headed. If you look at discipleship, particularly in Mark's gospel, the whole point of discipleship in Mark's gospel is they don't get it. Which helps me actually with the end of Mark. You know that dubious passage, you get Mark 16, 1 to 8, and then there's from 9 to 20. Was that passage really there? I don't think that passage is there at all. Because when you follow the flow of Mark's gospel, the disciples are clueless. So the best way to end a gospel where the disciples are clueless are for the women to go away afraid. End of book. They see the resurrection, don't know what's going on, they go away, afraid, end of book. And you can understand some scribe later on saying, "Look, this is not a good ending for a book. Let's make sure that the apostles start to, you know, to heal people and they get bitten by snakes and nothing happens to them, all that kind of stuff." No! The whole tone and tenor of Mark's gospel is the disciples don't get it, even after Jesus rises from the dead. The women go away afraid. And of course, the men aren't even in sight. That's discipleship. So anytime you want to invest in younger leaders, you are going to have those moments that they're just not getting it. And yet look at what happens to them with the gift of the Spirit and Jesus' life being lived out in front of it, and it takes them a while to see even the power of Jesus' life. We were thinking of the foot washing scene last night. It's probably weeks later that they really understand that. They don't get the teaching at first. They think Jesus is an oddball at first. And then little by little, we see he's not an oddball. Actually, there's something special about it. In fact, actually, he's the Messiah. In fact, more than that, he's the suffering Messiah, and I can't cope with that. But more than that, he's the suffering Messiah who rises from the dead again. And more than that, he's the suffering Messiah who rises from the dead again, gives us the gift of the Spirit, and then wants us to go and reach the world. It's a voyage of discovery from utter cluelessness to being world changers. And Jesus goes through that story with them. And, you know, when you start with training younger leaders, you'll go through the early parts of cluelessness until you get to that, right, he's called us to be world changers by the power of the Spirit, by preaching the death and resurrection of Messiah. But there's a long journey to travel there. So Jesus had his 72, had his 12, and he had his three, Peter, James, and John. And I would actually argue as well, he had his one. Because it was only to Peter that he said, feed my sheep. Peter, you are the first pastor of the church. And I don't want to go down the whole papalism track, and on this rock I'll build my church and all that kind of stuff. I think that's a nonsense, but as Protestants, we underplay the role of Peter, though, as well. He was appointed in a way that none of the 12 were appointed. And Peter's always kind of the spokesman for the disciples. He became the natural leader. He had a teachability, a cluelessness, but a teachability. It's fascinating as well that none of the 12 that Jesus chose had a seat in the synagogue. They were not the movers and shakers of their generation. They were fishermen. And you remember when the Sanhedrin say in Acts 4, we were amazed, Peter and John speaking to us, how eloquent they were. They're just fishermen. And it says they were amazed that they had spent time with Jesus. So, all of that to say, Jesus began to invest in younger leaders by calling people who seemed clueless, who did not have a place, they weren't movers and shakers in their areas at all, but they were teachable. They were teachable. That is utterly key. Have you found anyone in your church, whether your church has 10 people or 500, who is teachable and who will come and sit with you, then you could be onto something. And Jesus is actually commanding you to be onto something here. He is commanding. This is not, here's one of the nice options, training younger leaders. Training younger leaders is utterly core to your role in the church. I just want to get that across to you, because the whole Jesus' whole ministry revolves around this, but I hardly ever hear this taught or preached. So he had a 72, his 12, his 3, and his 1. And the more time he had in his 3 years of public ministry, he spent with smaller numbers of people to more fully invest in. And I'm even thinking now as I speak about this, he had his 12 on the last night, but who does he have the conversation with on the beach after he's risen from the dead? It's Peter. And of course, John wants in on the conversation, doesn't he? But he can't, because Jesus is just with Peter. So how do you relate that to your ministry? And of course, it's not just Jesus' ministry. Paul just naturally imbibes this as well. He's always mentoring. And we don't catch it because it doesn't seem to be the main thrust of any passage that Paul's involved in. But Paul is constantly traveling with Titus, with Barnabas. And actually, Paul began to learn about the church through Barnabas, didn't he, before they had that sad split. And when nobody wanted to take on Saul the Slayer, you know, the guy who was persecuting the church, it was Barnabas who mentored Saul. What would have happened in the church if Barnabas hadn't gone? And you see, actually, Barnabas is a regularly smoothing the way kind of person. He is sent by the disciples to Antioch to see what's going on in this new, very Gentile-feel church, which has a very different feel to the very traditional church in Jerusalem, this Gentile church called Antioch, which became the main missionary sender, actually. We'll send Barnabas. He's a guy who knows. He will rejoice in whatever work of God he sees. He'll not be blinded by tradition, because he's not from the Jewish central church. He's got a wider view of the world. So he can go, he can see the good things in Antioch and can promote the good things in Antioch. He did exactly the same with Paul. He saw in Paul what nobody else did. Everybody, you know, the church was worried, who is this Saul guy who's sending us to prison and killing us? And he suddenly says, he's converted. I've heard news on the grapevine, he's converted. I'm not going near him. But Barnabas does. Gets alongside Paul, mentors him when Paul is very wet behind the ears and probably too bold for his own good. And then because of that, suddenly Paul is introduced to the church and he becomes the main driving vision for the New Testament, really. Think of that mentoring role that Barnabas took on before they had their disagreement. I remember hearing the story of John Stott. You know, to my mind, the greatest preacher of the 20th century, greatest church leader of the 20th century. The night when he, as a 16-year-old, was returning from a youth group in church, and his youth pastor very nervously thought, I can't let John get out of the car without speaking to him about Jesus and the gospel, see where he's at. And that was the conversation that led to John stop becoming converted. I don't know the name of that youth leader, which is telling. But there was a guy who thought, there's a young man here, comes from a non-Christian family, I think, entirely, just turned up at a youth group. And then a leader saw something in this kid. And we are now, you know, churches across the globe are praising the Lord for John Stott and what he meant to the church, because somebody had an eye for him. Somebody was his Barnabas. Who are you looking out for? There could be an absolutely rough diamond in your church whom you thought was the last person that God would invest in. Start investing in him, and he's possibly a Peter in waiting or a John Stott in waiting. You know, you just can't see it. What God will do with a man or woman who is utterly committed to him. That's what D.L. Moody's famous words, which adorn the courtyard of Moody Bible Institute. D.L. Moody ran away from home when he was a kid. His father was a drunk. He was brought up in the cornfields of Massachusetts, where there was just nothing to do. He became apprenticed to a shoe salesman in Chicago. And then he got gloriously converted by another youth leader who came in, was wrestling all night thinking, I need to speak to this young man. So he went into the shoe shop where D.L. Moody was the apprentice, spoke to him about Jesus. D.L. Moody got converted. He couldn't pass his interview to become a member of the local church, the church that he later pastored and the church that later was named after him, Moody Church in Chicago. He wasn't eloquent enough to pass his first interview. So he had to be interviewed again. Come on, give me your story of conversion. He couldn't say a story of conversion. He was gloriously converted, but couldn't articulate it. Then finally, he became part of the church, started a Sunday school, started the YMCA, actually. And now 8 blocks of city center Chicago is the Moody Bible Institute. He came over to preach in Scotland and London. Revival came with him. And of course, the Moody and Sankey relationship. Sankey was the worship leader. Moody was the preacher. A guy who ran away from home, whose dad was a drunk, who couldn't articulate his conversion experience, but somebody saw something in him. You know, who is that guy in your church? Maybe the least likely one you're looking for. So Paul mentoring Timothy, mentoring Titus, mentoring Silas. I wonder if we looked at Timothy, would we have thought of him as good gospel candidate? I mean, his dad wasn't even a believer. His faith line came from his grandmother Lois and his mother Eunice. Timothy was this kind of, you know, he seems a shy, very shy guy. Different, has stomach problems. Young, so that Paul has to tell him, no one despise you because of your youth. Why do you think Paul had to say that? Because people were despising Timothy because of his youth. Paul, I don't know why he did this. He sends Timothy to Corinth, the beast of churches. You know, Corinth's a horrible church, and it actually remained horrible right into the New Testament. You know, to 120 AD, Clement of Rome is sending letters to Corinth saying, you've got to start behaving yourselves, people. But Paul sends little Timothy to Corinth, and then he says, I have no one like him. Really, Paul? Of all the great leaders that you've met the apostles, the pillars. But he says of little Timothy, little diffident Timothy with stomach problems who's nervous, I have no one like him, because he's meek, of course, as we were thinking about, and he's teachable. Would you have picked Timothy? And yet, Paul hands on the baton to Timothy in the most moving letter of the New Testament to Timothy. So Paul is always doing this mentoring thing. He's doing it instinctively. We just need to catch it and then produce it in our own churches. 2 Timothy 2:2 is really the key verse for the Young Leaders Academy that I'm going to talk about in a little minute. And you got to get this verse. Paul says, if you can picture me behind this, but the things you have heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to reliable men who will be able to teach others also. So this is 4 generations of passing on gospel ministry. So Paul to Timothy, Timothy to reliable men who will be able to teach others also. And this seemed to be the core of Paul's whole mentoring discipleship campaign. He led through leaders. Keep passing on the gospel. Keep training leaders. Keep investing in a small group of people who are teachable. And then you will be multiplying leadership. I've heard leadership described in two ways. There are two images of it. You can either be a banyan tree type of leader or a banana tree type of leader. A banyan tree is this mightily impressive tree with huge leaves, dense foliage, looks magnificent while it's alive, but everything underneath it dies because the tree with its deep foliage blocks all the sunlight and the rain from falling on anything underneath. That is the kind of vision of kind of the charismatic leader, small c, charismatic leader, who is the heart and soul of the church, and everybody hangs on every word he says, but he's not training other leaders. In fact, he likes the fact that everything revolves around him often, or he's just never thought about training and mentoring other people. He's a charismatic. And then what happens when that charismatic leader dies? While he's there, everybody's hanging on every word, but there's actually death happening because no one's really growing. No one's being driven out to go and do ministry now, go and do stuff, go and be leaders, go and all of that. It's all centralized, and everything dies underneath it. The banana tree is totally different. The banana tree is constantly adding leaves and branches to the central tree so that, if you could imagine that the trunk could see, the trunk cannot actually see the very last branch that's out there. It just keeps growing, keeps growing, keeps growing. And I have learned in leadership, I think, to just give it away as much as possible. And if the church is dependent on you as the leader having the finger on the pulse on everything that's happening in the church will die. There needs to be stuff going on in the church, leadership-wise, that you have utterly nothing to do with. That you are inspiring by your preaching and by the original mentoring that you did with those leaders that are going off and doing it. But then let the leaders go off and do it. Yeah? So banana tree leadership goes on into the next generation. It's the four generations kind of leadership. Banyan tree leadership. And I've seen this. I've seen this in some big churches as well. There was a church in Cardiff when I was there who had a brilliant leader, excellent teacher. Excellent preacher, hymn writer and everything. But when he went, the church was in turmoil. Who's going to be a successor here? There had been no real succession planning. There had been no real leadership preparation. So the church that had been a powerful church went into decline for a while. I think it's come back out of it. But when Moses died, Israel only had the prescribed time of 40 days of mourning before Joshua was right in place. The beautiful thing about Moses dying was that he was preparing Joshua. And you notice, actually, throughout the whole time, Moses is taking Joshua to one side. And there's this beautiful scene where God is talking with Moses at the tent of meeting as a man speaks to his friend, and Joshua's outside. And when Moses leaves again, Joshua's lingering there, hoping that some of the glory falls on him. Joshua was looking at Moses. Moses invited Joshua in to look at his life, and Joshua was being prepared so that when Moses died, which could have actually been catastrophe at such a key stage when they're about to move into the promised land, that's the time you don't want to lose your leader, you know, or there's a new building being built. Please don't lose the charismatic key leader that everything's been built around. Well, no, it hasn't been built around him. Moses has been praying to Joshua for years, and God was telling Moses actually to prepare Joshua. So the minute we get to the end of Deuteronomy, Moses was the meekest man on all the earth. Mourn for 40 days. Right, Joshua, come on, be strong in the Lord, his mighty power. Are you ready to lead Israel? Can we not give Moses a bit more mourning, please? A bit more time? What a great hero figure. Let's build a statue. Statues are always bad news, of course, in numbers and so on. But they're ready to move on. That was the beauty of Moses' leadership. The beauty of your leadership is that your church will be ready to move on when you go. And knowing how to pass the baton on. And I tell you, that will be more difficult than you think when you're 50 or 60. And your whole life's been built around this church, and you've given your best hours to it. And to have the humility to say, right, it's time. I truly admire leaders, maybe in their 60s, who've been really good leaders, really solid elders, really solid leaders, but they know now. Even if nobody else knows, or even if nobody else is telling them, everybody else is saying, please stay on. I know my time is coming. And I will humbly and gently fade off the stage and allow this new guy to come on. Quite often I hear about churches where there's been this charismatic and he just cannot go. Until people are pleading with him to go, he will not go. And he creates war and obstacles. I know two church splits in Scotland because of that precise issue. Because the guy just would not go. And then other churches where there's been a pastor in a church for years, a new pastor comes on. The guy says, look, please, you take over, but I'll stay in the church. Nightmare scenario. How can the new pastor come in with any kind of freedom when the guy who's been in everybody's homes for 20 years is sitting in the congregation? And some people in the congregation say, well, I don't like this new guy. He's a bit different. Well, of course he's different. He's a different person. And then, of course, the pastor gets, you know, I love the way you used to come and visit us. That always happens in a congregation. Get out of there. That's the problem with being a pastor, actually. You know that when your time's finished in a church, you probably need to get out of the town. Probably. You need to get out of the town. There may be unique situations where that's not the case, and if that's your situation, please don't, you know. But generally, let the next person come in and be their own person and make their own mistakes, because you made plenty of them as well, didn't you? When you were the Peter just discovering Jesus compared to the Peter who was changing the world through Jesus post-Pentecost. Yeah? So all of this to say, you need to have just a whole worldview of my time in ministry is not just for the content that I can give on a Sunday and the folks that I can visit around their homes to make sure they're okay. It's not just for my day. I want to create a generation of leaders who may well lead better than I do, and hallelujah when they do. You know, a few weeks ago, the youth pastor in our church, he was our first internal appointment because he was in this Young Leaders Academy that we were in. He preached a sermon that knocked my socks off. Sadly, it was significantly better than what I had preached in the morning. So he's not up for a while now, I tell you. But actually, do you know, for the first time, I wasn't jealous. I get desperately jealous of other preachers who preach brilliantly, and I've had to deal with myself on that. But hearing one of these guys do it, I felt like a father figure to him. It was beautiful. He ministered to my soul exactly what I needed. I just thought, praise the Lord, you know? And, you know, if my plane from Aberdeen to Norwich happened to get into trouble in mid-flight and it went plunging down, you know, there'd be a bit of mourning for a while, I'm sure, but there's a bunch of guys there ready. It's God's time for them. God's decided it's not time for me anymore. Have that mentality. It's so difficult to have that mentality, but the thing that's getting in the way is my pride. Because I don't care what kind of pastor you are, there's something within you that you need to wrestle with all your days that you want to be the greatest Christian leader that the 20th century has ever seen or 21st century has ever seen. And you're constantly wrestling with that, aren't you? And the people of you that think you're not wrestling with that, you're just not being honest. They were all wrestling with that. Give it away. As John the Baptist said, he must be greater and I must become less. John the Baptist had a bigger following than Jesus. Jesus was the new kid on the block. John the Baptist had people coming out from Jerusalem to the desert to hear him and only him. What a real adrenaline rush. Then they thought he was fantastic when he publicly stood up in front of Herod, gets thrown into prison. John's now the martyr figure. Phenomenal. What's John's response to that? He must become greater and I must become less. That's passing on leadership. John passed on leadership to Jesus. I've only just thought of that. I think that's true. John passed on leadership to the Son of God. Don't get in the way of God's work. And sometimes the best way for you not to get in the way of God's work is to get out of there. Anyway, enough said about that. And please, when you hear of, you know, this big problem in Aberdeen 15 years from now because, you know, I won't go, you know, write me a letter to say, you remember you said 15 years ago at that seminar, get out of the way. It's time for you. I may need that one day. Anyway, a pass-it-on culture is huge in the church, and I can't spend much time on this, but Priscilla and Aquila, of course, this is not just what a pastor does, a congregation. Priscilla and Aquila taking Apollos aside. Again, Apollos, here was this guy, he's got something about him. He's got Greek training. He's a better public speaker than Paul is. Paul practically admits that. And people gather around Apollos' teaching. The Corinth church loved Apollos' teaching, of course. He's classically trained. He is the orator, which if I had to guess who wrote the book of Hebrews, it would be Apollos. That's my best guess. I'll just say that as an aside. But clearly there was something beautifully trained about Apollos. He was ready, but he didn't know the gospel very well. And here's this couple, Aquila and Priscilla, you know, very quietly, come home with us, Apollos. Come and have lunch. And you don't realize, Apollos, that this lunch is going to have a bit of added extra. We're going to disciple you. And we're going to tell you about Jesus. And we're going to fill you in on the bits of the gospel that you're missing because we see something in you again that's going to light up the church. It's going to light up the church because when you speak, people are drawn to it. So let's do the quiet, humble work of building you up in the gospel so that you really know what you're talking about. Because when you talk, you're going to have golden words. And that seems to be what happened. Apollos was a man with golden words. But again, a couple this time, interestingly, led by a lady, came and mentored him at home. I'm a complementarian, but my complementarianism doesn't take women out of the training process at all. It ought not to be. Women should teach in Bible colleges. I'm convinced of that. Utterly convinced of that. We did Wayne Grudem's course on biblical manhood and womanhood in Chicago. And Wayne Grudem is the classic. He is the complementarian. Wayne Grudem would be pro-women teaching in Bible colleges and places like that. And certainly teaching in home scenarios in this kind of way. Priscilla did it. Let's not make our complementarianism an unbiblical complementarianism. Yeah? Priscilla did it at home. What do you think? Do you think Priscilla just shut up while Aquila said it all? If she did, why is she always mentioned first? You know, and we've wrestled with it. My wife is a better preacher than I am. And we're having to wrestle with what that looks like. She does not preach week by week in the local church, but she preaches at the Keswick Convention. Because it's not the local church led by a group of elders, led by church government. Have you really nuanced your view of complementarianism? Because often churches that parade their complementarianism are actually patriarchal, which means women do nothing more than serve tea at conferences. And that cannot be true. In the early church, what do you think Philip's prophesying daughters did? Made the tea? They're prophets. Anyway, I'll leave it there. But I'm a convinced complementarian, but it's nice to be a bit edgy in a seminar, isn't it? Point two now. Are other things getting in the way of you training younger leaders? This is a key thing. Before we get into what training looks like, are other things getting in the way? And I see this in churches everywhere. Pastoral care drives the agenda because older ones in the church are calling for it. So, pastor, I want you to spend all your time both preparing your sermons and then coming and visiting me because I've just been in hospital or I'm going into hospital, all this kind of stuff. Of course, that kind of care in the church is necessary. Controversial point, the pastor, who is the teacher of the church, should be the last person to do it. Elders should be doing it. Congregation should be trained to be doing it. To free the guy who can mentor and train people in preaching and theology and all that kind of stuff, to leave him free to do a lot of that stuff. I do some visiting of older people, but I do about 10% of the visiting that's done. And I've spent the first 5 years of my time in Deeside trying to get people away from the thought of the pastor, well, his job is to come around to my living room, have cups of tea with me, and discuss my latest health issues. You know? But this is the cork in the bottle that's stopping training in the local church, in so many churches. I gave a talk in Derby about this, and almost every minister came up and said exactly the same thing. And it's often the older ones who are going through health difficulties, and it's health difficulties that dominate care in the church. Where are we going to end up in the church if it's health difficulties that are dominating all our time? What about getting the young and the enthused together for training? And of course, there has to be a balance. There needs to be looking after the old and the infirm and those that are sick, yes. But at least half of our care time needs to be devoted to training the young who are not actually calling out for it. That's the problem. The loudest voices win here. The loudest voices who have always expected, because the church for the last 50 years has had a pastor who's come around to our house and talked to me about my illnesses. No, that can be done, but that's a Galatians 6:2 thing. Carry one another's burdens. And actually, I know, particularly ladies in our congregation, they are better at that empathic care than I am. But somehow my visit is sanctified and theirs isn't. Get your church out of that way of thinking, because it's going to stop you producing leaders in your church. You are the one who's called to produce leaders. Absolutely. And of course, in the plurality of elders, you remember the plurality of elders that's talked about? The plurality of elders, I think the vision is there that one or two of them were devoted to the teaching of the word, so that the other elders would do a lot of pastoral care. So this pastor-shepherd thing, we've got wrong, I believe. 80% of the way that I shepherd the flock is by teaching them sound doctrine on Sunday, and that keeps the wolves out. And 20% of mine is major people involvement, which will be some visitation of older folks, but if I can pass that on, I will do it, so that I can focus on the young guys and girls who are going to be the future of the church. Now, you may completely disagree with that, but I'm launching that out there for you to think about. Okay? Other things are driving the agenda other than training younger leaders. Looking after the old at the expense of the young is just not good strategy, is it? Actually, Jesus didn't do it. How much time did Jesus spend in people's homes that were part of the church or the believing community who were ill, talking to them about their illnesses? He just healed them and went on. Essentially, and then taught them, and then spent most of his time with his 12, who would be the leaders who would go and do the work. Ephesians 4, here, you know, Ephesians 4:11, our great verse, God has called some to be apostles, pastors, you know, and pastors and teachers, what are they to do? To do works of service? No. To prepare God's people for works of service. Your job is to mobilize your church so that it becomes the priesthood of all believers, one of the great Reformation tenets. Is your church the priesthood of all believers? Or is the church, you know, a bit like a football field on a Saturday, where there are, you know, 22 guys sweating and doing all the work, while 40,000 are having a nice spectator show? That's what a lot of churches are like. And we, but because we're not envisioning people to do that. I would just say to you, most of pastoral care in your church needs to be done not by the lead pastor or the teacher of the church, so that you're free to do what God's called you to do. Weddings, funerals, committee meetings, budgeting, it drives me crazy. We have a group in our church now that are looking into the possibilities of changing our building. I'm not having a thing to do with it. I'm getting out of there. A, because I'm completely useless at that anyway. I mean, I would just be a cork in the bottle. They'd only ask me to come and open in prayer and close in prayer anyway, which they can do perfectly well themselves. But if I'm spending time on an important role, of course, looking at new buildings is an important thing in the church. Yes, it is. It's not for me. If I spend time with them, I am not training that young preacher who's going to go to that other church on a Sunday to preach the gospel. So I'm doing what God's called me to do, and I'm very thankful for competent guys who know much more about buildings than I do anyway. And they'll probably talk to me at some stage if they're worried about it. If the pulpit's the wrong size when the new building's built, I'll tell them and we'll get a new pulpit in. Big deal. And then this big question, if or when you leave, who will take over? Who are you preparing to take over for your ministry? The whole Moses Joshua thing. The thing about Hezekiah that it says, remember that scene in Hezekiah where God prolongs Hezekiah's life and he prays and all this and it's all wonderful? And God tells him, well, in the future, the Babylonians are going to come and wipe you out. And Hezekiah doesn't say, oh no, Lord, what can we possibly do to change that scenario? He says, oh, great, at least it's not happening in my day. You know, and there's something wrong there. At least it's not happening in my day. You know, are you looking after the church for when you go? Right, so let me jump into this case study. Any questions or comments about that before I move on? What time are we, by the way? Because I've got no... How long have we done so far? 10 past 12, did somebody say? 20
past 12.
20 past 12, right. Quick question. Any questions at all? Great, I'll move on. Case study, Deeside Christian Fellowship in Aberdeen. Now, just to say, this is just my home church. I'm just going to tell you now what we do for training younger leaders. Please don't see this as a paradigm that's like a cookie cutter that I'll bring this into my local church. To be honest, how we've done it is a bit of a mess. I do the best that I can at this, get support from the elders. But hopefully what I say about what's happening at Deeside will give you some ideas for what is possible in your local situation. Bearing in mind, we have a church of 450, 500 people who come, so I've got, I guess, a lot of 20-somethings, for example, to choose from. I have not deliberately not called together 40-somethings or 50-somethings who are settled in family life already. I just think you can't shape 40 and 50s like you can shape 20s. It's as simple as that. It's younger leaders, and I guess Jesus' disciples would have been pretty young when he called them. If Jesus was 30 himself, and they were probably younger than him, some of them would have been very young. That's when he started calling them. So I literally handpicked a bunch of 20-somethings who were showing promise in the church. And I did this in connection with the elders because I didn't want to just be a lone ranger where this was concerned. Please, elders, I have this idea. Do you think it's a good idea? Yes, it's a good idea, Jeremy. Then we prayed about who were the young guys that we thought had something about them. So were they leading in youth work? Were they showing some kind of initiative? You know, there was something about them that was teachable. It was strange. There have been a couple of guys that we've had to leave out of this who were sons of elders and had been brought up in the church and had this kind of expectation in their souls that if anybody was going to be chosen for this, it's going to be me. And because of that, we said no, because there wasn't the teachability there. Teachability is the core here. It's not how long they've been in the church or which family they're connected to. But are there your Peters, your sponges, who will do stupid things and say stupid things, but once they learn, they'll get it and they'll go for it? Teachability is the core here. So what I did, I selected 12. It was one of the wonderful strategies, just, well, Jesus did it, so it might work here. 12 of them, actually, a little bit more work than that. For a small group to work properly, they say between 8 and 12 regularly attending is important. So they get enough discussion between them, but it's not too big so that people are drowned out. No more than 12, they say, is a pretty good way of thinking of small groups generally for regular attendance. So I sent a letter around to 12 of these guys and said, look, I'm thinking about starting this Young Leaders Academy, reading books that you would never think of reading, coming together for 2 hours on a Saturday morning to talk preaching, to talk theology, to talk church history, and to have accountability relationships with each other. Come to an introductory session. Let me share it with you. See what you think. Go away and pray about it. And if you want to sign up, come on ahead. Not having a clue what was going to happen here. Had no idea. And I was amazed just that the first session we had sitting around, I just asked them, you know, how did you feel when you got that letter? And God was already doing stuff. And I hadn't done a thing other than write a letter. Somebody's investing in me. This is the ridiculous thing. I thought that this would take so many hours of my life, and it hasn't. It really hasn't. They just feel invested in. And they felt that God was raising the bar on their life. They had been doing a little bit of youth work or a little bit of children's work or something, and suddenly come aside and do a special discipleship group here. This is how they saw it. And right away, God was starting his work. And here's an important thing, I think. Don't bring on the weak, invest in the strong. Let me tell you what I mean by that. By the weak, I mean there are people on the periphery of church life who you think, well, we need to bring them on a bit. Yes, you do need to bring them on a bit, but they're not the ones who have earned the right to be in a discipleship group. You want those who have shown some kind of hunger for the Lord, some kind of, you know, desire to serve. And they don't have to be hugely competent. They just need to have some hunger for the Lord. They've got to be self-starters from that angle, so that when you come and say, I want a discipleship, and you're going to read systematic theology, they're not going to say, oh, not systematic theology. Going, oh, wow, right, well, yeah, let's go for it then. You've got to have that type right from the start. So this is not to try and bring your weaker ones on a bit more. This is to get your strong ones investing in them so that they can be the best that they can be and lead the weaker ones. Do you see? So it's not abandoning the weaker ones. It's saying the best way to reach the weaker ones is not by the 30 minutes I can preach on a Sunday, but by these guys who are investing and building relationships and will be leading in days to come. And 20-somethings have time to be shaped. We meet once a month. This is just very practical. This is what happens. We meet once a month on a Saturday morning, usually the third Saturday of the month. And we do it from 8 in the morning till 10 for a couple of reasons. Number one, some of these guys are family guys with kids, and you want to give them enough of a Saturday to have time with their kids and their family and not abandon that. We also want it to be early in the morning to sort out the men from the boys, if I could put it that way. You know, and in Aberdeen, it gets really dark from about now. You know, so when I walk to this thing, because I'm 5 minutes from the church, it's easy for me. When I walk to this thing at 7:30 on a Saturday morning, it is pitch dark. And that in itself is saying, how much do you want this, boys? Because if you don't want this, it's not going to happen. You've got to want this. And it's not going to fit snugly into your life plan. You've got to want this to make it happen. And so we come in the dark, 8 o'clock in the morning, and we have breakfast together. Very simple breakfast, you know, just croissants and all that kind of stuff. Pretty unhealthy, actually. But we just chat for the first few minutes. Just how's your week been, all this kind of stuff, and get a bit of camaraderie going. And then we have a preacher. Now, this preacher is someone that I have met up with beforehand, so sometime in between the monthly meeting, I will arrange to meet up, usually in a coffee shop or hopefully at their work, if I can do that, during a lunch break. They know the passage that they're teaching. We've gone through, we began with 2 Timothy, surprise, surprise, so that they're learning about passing on the baton and leadership all the way through, but they're also learning how to preach a New Testament text. Always start with some kind of Paul epistle, because it's the easiest one to train people in teaching for, to begin with. So we go through 2 Timothy. I've divided up all the book into various chapters, like I would do a preaching program, and each of the guys alphabetically just slot into their passage. So I then meet up with the guy who's the preacher for that week. We would have an hour and a half together maybe. What I find with these guys is they're actually pretty good at getting a general understanding of the text, and they're very good on illustration. They're better on illustration than I am, which is scary. Their problem is structure. They do not know how to structure. And I think structure is the hardest bit of preaching anyway, getting that big idea, getting the... So often I say to them, don't come to me with your completed sermon. Come to me with a big idea and an outline, and let's talk about that. So I have to meet with them early enough, maybe 2 weeks into this process, so that they've still got 2 weeks to work on what I tell them. We come together, we discuss the passage together. If it's in a coffee shop or some public area, that's great, because you're also sharing the gospel as you do that. We speak loudly enough so that other people hear, what's this guy? I mean, he's praying with this younger guy? What are they even meeting for? Are they gay? Anyway, we do this training, Bible training preparation, and I help them mostly with structure. And then say, well, let's try and get a big idea and main points that are a wee bit better than what you've brought here. And then go off, produce your full sermon manuscript, send it to me a couple of days before you to preach it, and I'll maybe make a few adjustments. I can't rewrite some of the sermons. I just know they're not great, some of them, though I've been surprised at how many are good. And I try and readjust bits and pieces, but you can't rewrite the whole thing. You just make a couple of suggestions at that stage, a couple of days before they're about to preach, and then they preach on the Saturday in front of the group of 12. They preach. They can't preach for more than 15 minutes. So 1 Timothy 1, 1 to 8, 15 minutes on that. And then 2 Timothy 1, 1 to 8. And then the guys will give their comments, their feedback. Now, of course, they're usually generous because they know they've got to do it as well. And we always start feedback with, what did so-and-so do well? So we never say, this was rubbish. We say, what did he do well? Let's talk about this. And what are a couple of areas we could grow in? You know, which is an easier way of saying the stuff that needs to be said. Here's what I've found. I've done the current group that I'm with. I've done 2 years out of the 3.5 that I hope to do with them. I've done 2 years so far. And the comments that the guys are making now about the preaching are so much better than the comments that they started with. So much more insightful. Yes, I got your big idea. Yes, your big idea was repeated all the way through the sermon. Your transitions were really good. Your illustration, this one could have been better. This one could have been a bit more personal. That kind of thing. To begin with, it was just, I don't know what to say. So I had to do a lot of the talking. Now they're doing almost all the talking, and it's good sermon feedback. They're learning the processes. And the preaching has improved so much. And there was one guy in particular who the first time, he preached, he couldn't look at us for a start. He had done what he could, faithful to the text, but it really wasn't going anywhere. The third time that he preached, and nobody was expecting much, he knocked our socks off. Still didn't look at us very well, but the content was beautiful. And almost his nervousness and diffidence made us listen to him more. And he was built up so much by that session because he never thought he would speak publicly in front of anybody. Now he was preaching and people were being blessed by his preaching. Wow! It wasn't a perfect sermon, but I can't remember I've ever preached a perfect sermon either. And you can see them grow just with... Because right away you're exposing them publicly to sharing Christ. That in itself is a great thing. Then you're teaching them how to preach. Then you're helping them receive critique and be open to that and want that, which then also helps them in their spiritual lives to want that. I want critique, please. Don't let me just live a life that's mediocre. Let people come and tell me how to get better, and I'm ready for that. And they do it in this collegial atmosphere that's warm, that everybody's together in and everybody's got to do it. And I'm sitting there thinking, I haven't done anything really. I just met with a guy for coffee for an hour. We had a great chat about a Bible text. I loved it. So I have spent over a month, 3.5 to 4 hours preparing for this. They do the work. And so I can still do a lot of stuff in my ministry that's not, with younger leaders. And I'm giving the leadership away. So the first 30 minutes is preaching. They preach. Then there's a review of it. Then systematic theology. We've got the Grudem's Bible Doctrine book, not the shorter one, which is the gray one, which is, the one for the cowards. We've got the big one, which is the 1,623-page one that, people would leave their doors. It's a doorstopper kind of book. And I deliberately make a big play on this, I'm giving you books that you would never have read. And I want you to be so excited by them that you can't imagine you've missed them in your life. And over 3 years, we just take each chapter. We skip some of them, which are a bit lazy, but we do most of them. So the authority and sufficiency of Scripture, who Christ is, how the deity of Christ, humanity of Christ, the atonement, predestination, all of this kind of stuff. We just go through chapter by chapter, and each guy presents that chapter for 15 minutes, and then we discuss it together. I love it. I love it. I never get to discuss doctrine. Nobody else wants to discuss doctrine. I get to discuss doctrine, but it has a practical edge to it as well. So when we have our difficult talk, and that predestination chapter is always a difficult talk, and the ultimate, and somebody has a non-Christian father or mother or brother, and then we start talking, Pastor, how would you talk to somebody like that who's worried about their brother and predestination, God's called them? How do we relate the gospel to that? And they are learning how to talk pastorally and sensitively about theology to other people. They don't know that they're being prepared to be elders and deacons and key leaders in the church, but that's what's happening. Because we bring the theology away from just theory into real life. And how would you communicate this to someone else? So that's the second 30 minutes. Chapter of Grudem, then we discuss it together. The third 30 minutes is church history. People think, why do you choose church history? because I loved it when I was at Bible college. That's the simple idea. Changed my life. I hated history in school, but I got a brilliant church history teacher called John Woodbridge in America, just totally knocked my socks off. He was a brilliant communicator, and I didn't realize church history could be so interesting. So I'm thinking, I can only pass on to these guys what I'm passionate about. Church history wouldn't need to be an element in something like this, but I've chosen it to be because I can pass that on passionately. I tend to take the church history chapter. We've done a book by Bruce Shelley called Church History in Plain Language. It reads like a novel. So, I mean, there's some church history books that really would bore you to tears. I mean, they really do. You know, some people have just an art of boring people. But this book, it reads... some people who thought, I can never get into church history, have loved this book. And so we'll do, you know, the first 300 years in a chunk in the first chapter, and then I'll present. I try and present that because church history is such a new concept to them. I want to get them get across what are the main themes of church history. What church history does for them, actually, is it helps them not to be so precious about their own little ecclesiological background, you know, which is a huge danger in the British church. I come from a Brethren background, and it's kind of, you know, in that background often there's, you know, in heaven there will be a little corner there for the Brethren. There's that mentality. I'm sure Baptists often feel the same, and the Presbyterians often feel the same. Seeing who God has used in the muck and madness of church history. We were reading the other week about Ignatius Loyola, the Jesuit leader of the Counter-Reformation. What a guy. His spiritual exercises would make you weep. His devotion to God would make you weep. And what was he trying to do? Basically trying to kill Protestants. And here is the chaos of church history, but the people that we learn from. You know, some of the most godly men you would ever know in the 1000s were telling people to go off on crusades and kill people in the Holy Land and reclaim it. And what comes across, of course, is in the madness, God uses his people, but don't have any one supreme hero figure. Martin Luther, Martin Luther's the great hero, brought about Reformation, back to the Bible movement, and then said some stuff at the end of his life about Jews in particular that Hitler used later on. So all of them were huge sinners as well. You know, Calvin himself assents to the death of Michael Servetus, you know, and gets him burned at the stake and so on. Now, people have different views on how Calvin made that happen, but we can't make Calvin the fourth member of the Trinity either. He was a sinner as well. But we learn some wonderful things about him. And learn some. When they start learning about revival, 1741, because it's my favorite period, you know, George Whitefield and John Wesley and the preaching that went, and then the battle between Wesley and Whitefield over predestination and Arminian and Calvinism, and suddenly they're getting into issues they didn't even think were there. And they realize that the church is much bigger than they thought, that theology is much more interesting than they thought. And then they think, well, I'm now part of church history. What am I going to do in my generation? You know, when these guys, you know, you hear about John Bunyan and his life before he came to faith and his struggles in coming to faith, 3-year crisis before coming to faith. And this guy wrote the book in a prison that is the second most read book outside, in the English language outside the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress. Anyway, this is the stuff that happens as we do church history together. So I'll present it and then we'll have a discussion about it. Then the fourth section is somebody sharing their life map. We want to make it very personal at the end. So they'll say, you know, here are the influences that have blessed my Christian life so far. So let me share them with you. And then when that individual has shared their life influences, we'll all gather around him, lay hands on him, and pray for him. And three guys tend to pray for that individual. And we do that each time so that everybody both shares their testimony, in a sense, and gets prayed for in their lives. And we're done by 10. Well, normally 10:15 or so. And then they go home. And we meet the next month, and the preacher for the next time is getting in touch with me for meeting up with me and so on. That's how it works. It takes very little time out of my calendar. It's the most exciting thing that I do. And here's the problem. I've been 14 years in ministry now. You can get bored with ministry, believe you me. I'm not saying bored with God. That's a different thing. But you can get bored with ministry, can't you? Chugging along. The thing that keeps me refreshed and excited is seeing these young guys with all their odds and edges who are being shaped. It keeps me excited. It keeps me wanting to preach to them. 6 months into the Young Leaders Academy, I thought, we need to do something with women here, particularly the wives of the guys who were part of the group, and there were several wives. Huh. One of my group, an Australian called Brendan, came to me and said, the classic words, which I have rarely listened to in the past, I've been having repeated dreams about you, Jeremy. I thought, what? He says, I don't understand these dreams. But there were two very distinct ones. One, that he saw me on the top of the steps of the church with the congregation at the bottom of the steps, but I was both at the top of the steps and moving around the congregation somehow. That was around the time where we were appointing our first ever care pastor, who was able to move among the people so that I was free to be a bit more of visionary kind of thing. And he also said, in that congregation, there were people in pink jumping and cheering. People in pink. He says, I don't know what this means, but there were people in pink jumping and cheering. And I look back now, it's the only one in 14 years of ministry where I believe that was God speaking to me through a prophetic word, which we can't despise, of course, as Thessalonians tells us. But I'm always skeptical about it. Every time, I'm hugely skeptical about it. I just say, yeah, thanks, I'll think about that. And then I go off and, you know, this was so God saying, get women involved. And I had been thinking about it, but I thought, I'm not going to go for this. I've got too much on my plate. But this was so, I just can't tell you all the story around it that made this so real. And there's a lady in our church who has been a leader of Bible study fellowship for 14 years, who had been, so she was teaching and then she was training ladies to communicate the Bible. And she was perfectly placed. And I said, Jenny, she was a wife of an elder as well. I said, Jenny, would you fancy us getting together to discuss a group of 20-something women that might start here? And the women are outstripping the men. I mean, they're incredible. And it's changed marriages in the church, you know, because the women are more enthusiastic about the theology in the church history, partially because somebody asked them to do it. And some of the stuff they produce, they study the book of Ruth while we do 2 Timothy. And some of the messages that they have produced are outstanding. Outstanding. And I'm thinking, where do we go with this? And I don't have big answers. But we have now had 30 women as well as 30 men trained in this thing. And I'm starting to think church planting. Because we have this reservoir now of people. And the women are going to be as core to that church planting as the men. They're probably not going to teach weekly doctrine to the gathered congregation, but there's an awful lot of ways to skin a cat. And they're going to be deeply involved in the life of the church. In fact, I don't know about you, but during the week in church, it's 90% women who come and do the ministry in the church because they're around and available often, and they're good. Like the great Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius, who said, what great women these Christians have. Because it was during a time there was a big plague, and the Christians who were most helping and dying while they helped the plague victims were women. And so just release women to be all for God that they can be. But if you can show me one verse in Scripture that suggests to me that we should not train women to be confident in Scripture, confident in Bible doctrine, confident in church history, and having accountability relationships with each other, and training younger women, I also think that women should be able to preach evangelistically to non-believers. Tell me one verse where that can't happen either. Salvation Army was built on it. Street preaching by women to the unconverted, because it's not local church, family of God. Again, I got that from Wayne Grudem, the champion of complementarianism in America. But do we ever think about that? Could I send out some female street preachers to do evangelistic street preaching? Now there's an idea. So that's where I'm at. You might completely disagree with our approach. That's fine. This is not a thus saith the Lord thing. You just asked me for my story. That's my story. And it's actually changed some of my perspectives as I've done it as well. So that's where I'm at. So that explains part C, Young Women's Academy, which has 30 women who are just blossoming in all kinds of ways. And of course, the side-on effect is, how do you think a guy who's been to the Young Leaders Academy and a girl who's been to the Young Women's Academy, who are then married and raising kids, how do you think they're going to raise their kids?
How do a smaller church cope in terms of, you might have a guy with a minister and preaches twice on a Sunday, smaller congregation, maybe there might be one younger person in their 20s who you see, actually, that would be, or you know,
Yeah, and that's a completely different situation to the one I've got. And I, you know, publicly, you know, absolutely. But start with what you've got. Get that 19-year-old, invite him home for tea. Start talking to him. Start opening the Bible with him. Can we read a discipleship book once a month? See what comes of that. How are you going to solve the fact that you're preaching twice on a Sunday? I mean, I could not survive if I was preparing two different sermons. How can you give 15 hours a week to preaching if you're preaching morning and evening? And I know probably most of you are. Morning and evening, different sermons on different things. What else are you going to do? And how are you going to solve that problem? By training other preachers. So that they take the evening when you take the morning? Potentially, down the line. Ever thought of training that 19-year-old to be the preacher in the evening? What would happen to the church if you did that? It would probably be almost as scary as Hebrews 11, the chapter of faith. Lord, do more with this than I can possibly think that you would do. But start with where you're at. Is it one person that you can invest in? Find some way of beginning to invest in them. And also, is there another person who might be a great pastoral carer? I've trained two guys up to take funerals so that I don't have to. Two other guys take weddings. And they do it quite nicely. And they didn't think they could do it. But they also have more time to meet up with the people that they're about to marry as well. You would be amazed if you started to think, what resource do I have in front of me here in these people? What do you think they may be capable of doing that I've never thought that they could do? Who's got a hunger about them that can be shaped by Christ? I remember my first ever public oratory was when I was 14 years old. I had to tell a testimony at a gospel service on a Sunday evening. I had one side of paper with lines on it, spiral notepad job. I had written in Bic pen, one bit here, a few arrows down here. In the middle of my testimony, I was so nervous, I stopped for fully a minute, which feels like forever when you're on a pulpit. I just wanted to get down from there, sweating profusely, and get out of there. And never thought I'd be here now. Never thought I'd be here now. But somebody asked me, probably quite crazily, why don't you tell your testimony on a Sunday night? And we can either have neatly packaged Sunday mornings and Sunday nights for the rest of time, or we can train some younger leaders. But you've got to choose. And you're going to have some Sunday evenings that dive bomb, in which you're telling your congregation, come on guys, let's work with this. Let's accept this for a little while until so-and-so, who's got something about them but has a lot of rough edges, gets better. Or you can have neatly packaged Sundays until you retire and everything else stops. Or you have to do the crazy thing of looking around the whole country to see is there somebody else that can come and take over who's a professionally trained pastor.
It could be done by just a number of churches getting together and doing exactly this. Because if it's smaller churches and you've got just one or two people, then there's probably another church with the same, and so it grows. And then you can combine the resources.
Great. But just start thinking about it.
Yeah.
And I'm being slightly edgy here and saying some slightly controversial things that might make you angry, get you to think about it. I don't have a perfect paradigm for all your churches. I've had enough struggles in my own, to be honest. And I'm making my Young Leaders Academy sound such a wonderful baggage, I can tell you sometimes it is not in anything but. And we've had the frustration of, you know, I hear one of my young guys preach on a Sunday evening from the pulpit, and I was just, oh, please, don't anybody else ask me about this. And I know what they're going to say at the elders' meeting. That was just awful, and I know it was just awful, you know. And actually, because we had a couple of experiences like that, what I've done is say, well, take them out of that firing line. But there are other local churches around who have 10 or 15 people in them who don't actually have any preacher at all. So out of this 30 young guys that I've been training, there have been seven that have seemed to handle preaching quite well. And I send them down to Arbroath. They're up in Bucky on the north coast in churches that don't actually have a preacher at all. So anything that the guy brings will be welcome. And they're a very loving little community, very loving. And they're preaching and they're getting better there. And then if they move from there, can they lead on a Monday night prayer meeting? And then from the Monday night prayer meeting, can they start Sunday evening? And then perhaps when they're the peak of the crop, they may do a Sunday morning. So there's a stage of exposure. Preach at YLA. If you show that you can do it there, we might send you to another little gathering who might be really blessed by your visit and will show you love as you do that. And I always have somebody in that little gathering who gives me feedback as well. Then Monday night prayer meeting, which is 30 or 40 people gathered. Then Sunday evening and so on. I made the massive mistake of launching them straight into Sunday evenings. And I had to recover some of them because I made such a stupid decision. And say, this didn't go very well. Let's be honest about this. But this is not the end of the road. Let's try again. But what's your alternative? We need to develop gospel workers. And the local church, our problem, we're doing this Pathways Conference, and we had a few guys coming to the Pathways Conference. Their biggest problem is their local churches, not even vaguely interested in sending them to train, and there's no training happening in the local church. And you wonder why the number of churches that are closing. Because there's nobody there to preach. So where are they going to start? Question here, sorry.
Can I just ask about your wisdom on how we develop a culture of training where I can say to a young guy, I don't think you're a preacher, and it doesn't crush him? Because it seems to me that our danger in our circles is that we so elevate preaching that we make that the gift that everyone wants, in the same way that we'd look at Soul Survivor and say everyone wants to be Matt Redman, everyone wants to be a worship leader,
yeah.
And when you can't play guitar, it's like, oh, bummer. We've done the same thing, potentially, where our training is so preaching-focused that for the guy who's not a preacher, he's something else.
That's very interesting. It's interesting for me to hear that. My problem was the exact opposite. In D-side, everybody wanted to play guitar and be Matt Redman. Nobody wanted to preach. And actually bringing them together was, you ever think about preaching? But it's very interesting. How do you tell something? In my own experience, having this forum of 3 years where they're practicing preaching, they tend to work it out for themselves. And actually, it's trying to encourage those who I think can preach to say, you might have a call from God here. I've got to try. Now, maybe my Aberdeen situation is totally different from yours, and everybody wants to preach, and you have to kind of get them to calm down. I haven't found that in Aberdeen. I find the reverse, that they need to be given confidence that God might be calling them into preaching that they've never thought of before. But there needs to be, the thing is, if you've developed 3 years of this real honesty about everything in your life, some of the guys have talked openly about their pornography problems, and we talk openly about that. So me telling them, I probably don't think you're called to preach, is not going to shatter them because of 3 years of absolutely rigorous honesty. And they've been doing accountability, and the series of questions that they ask each other is like the Gestapo. Every single week we ask, what are you reading in your Bible? Who are the 5 people in your sphere of influence that you're witnessing to and wanting to bring to Christ? How are you using your money? What have you looked on the internet? And the last question is always, have you lied to me? And you've got to look the person straight in the face to answer that question. That's accountability between the two of them. So when I say, look, I really don't think that you're called to preach, it's not going to blow their head off. It may have done in the first week, but not in the third year, which is the time that we really start to say, right, where are we going to go with this? And I've just done this, and I haven't had a lot of backlash. I expected more backlash, but when I went to the 30, I've got a preaching group of 7 now. When I chose those 7, I didn't get any of the other guys saying, why not me? I didn't. Now, maybe in other situations you might. I don't know. But that's my best answer that may not be very wise. What time are we? Oh, gosh. Really sorry about that. I didn't even finish on that 7 with a preaching biff, but I've said a lot of stuff today. And as I say at the end of almost everything from preaching to this, whatever was not of the Lord, there's nothing thus saith the Lord about this. Whatever's not of the Lord, please let it be quickly forgotten. I don't want to offend anybody here, and I know that my situation's so totally different from yours. But if a little bit of edginess will get us all to think about the people resource that's right in front of us that we might not have thought of before, and taking risks and maybe having some cringeworthy Sunday evenings or Wednesday night Bible studies because somebody's just learning the trade, I think that's a good thing. And if you try this for 6 months and you've had a few too many cringeworthy ones, you can always pull back. But your people will also know, hey, we're trying things in this church. We're taking risks. And as we all know, the word risk is spelt F-A-I-T-H. You read Hebrews 11. Read Hebrews 11 and understand the scenarios that Abraham and Moses and all these guys found themselves in before they exercised faith, and then go back to your church and be happy with everything remaining the way it always was. Can't. And church planting starts from this. You start somewhere, even with one. And I'll just close with, I've been reading Charles Simeon, complete odd bod, became a pastor in a church in Cambridge. Everybody hated him to begin with because he was an evangelical preacher. In fact, the guy used to, his warden used to lock the pews so that no one could get in for the first 2 years of his ministry, and he had to wrestle with everybody about this. He developed a training program, which has been the inspiration for John Stott's hero was Charles Simeon. And I kind of been reading Charles Simeon because I heard about this guy. On his mantelpiece, he had portraits of all the guys, raw recruits, that he, over 50 years in Cambridge, had just gathered together in his little study for little accountability groups, little preaching sessions that were disastrous to start with, little prayer groups that didn't seem to be going anywhere. And he became a missionary to India. He became a pastor in Scotland. He became, you know, his whole mantelpiece was lined with his sons in the faith, one of whom was Henry Martyn. That was the biggest one that he had, actually. Some people thought he worshipped Henry Martyn in the end, actually. But Henry Martyn was just a kid in his Sunday school. And he took him aside, invested in him, and Henry Martyn became the great. If you read Henry Martin's life, wow. He's the guy that once wept at a Buddhist ceremony when he heard that Jesus was being slandered. And he came away, he couldn't control his tears that his Savior could be spoken of in those terms. That was Henry Martyn. And he started as a raw recruit under Charles Simeon. Who are going to be the guys that you're going to pass the baton to? The things you've heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, and trust a reliable man who will be able to teach others also. Father, just help us, and whatever has been good about this, may it go with us. Whatever has been bad about this, or stupid things that I've said when I shouldn't have said them, may it be quickly forgotten. May our churches be blessed, and may we even little by little target people in our church who have got a hunger about them, invest in them a little bit more, and produce workers for the harvest field. Father, raise up more workers for your harvest field, not just from training institutions, which have very few people in them anyway, but from our local churches. May our local churches become a hotbed of biblical training, risk-taking, church planting, that we might win England for Christ. And Scotland as well, Lord, would be good. Amen.